Before we begin today's presentation, can we just take a moment to honour the service and sacrifice of Australian servicemen and women? If I could just ask you all to please stand. They shall grow not old as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun and in the morning, we will remember them. Lest we forget. Please be seated. It is now my pleasure to introduce our speaker for today, Paul Hann. Paul is the author of Kokoda, a book that provides a detailed account from both the Australian and Japanese sides of the war into the treacherous and costly conditions of the Kokoda Track. But today, we're very fortunate to have Paul here to discuss the Vietnam War and Australia's participation in it. Australia's involvement in Vietnam began in 1962 and came at great cost to the Australian nation, as it did to many nations around the world. Paul's book, Vietnam, the Australian War, has been called an essential reading for Australians of all ages. Paul draws on the personal accounts of politicians, soldiers and aid workers, entertainers and the Vietnamese people in order to provide one of the most comprehensive accounts of the Vietnam War and its effects on the Australian nation. Can I please ask that you make Paul feel welcome, and I'll hand over to him from here.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that welcome, and also for inviting me to this magnificent building, a shrine to fallen Australian soldiers, which I've been to in the past but never spoken at, so it's an honour for me to be here. Thank you very much. Speaking of remembrance and forgetting and remembering, that very moving line at the end of the ode, lest we forget, what is it that we are remembering, we are inclined or obliged to remember, or we want to remember? Politicians, when they're at a meeting or a service for the fallen soldiers, I'm often looking at them and I'm wondering, what are they remembering? What are they commemorating? What are they thinking? And I think to turn this question on its head, I'm often asking, what are they forgetting? What are they leaving out? And what is it, therefore, my duty to try to actually inject into the story so that we don't forget? This is the rather modest role of the historian, to try to put together the narrative, to furnish it with facts, of course, but also to try to approach an approximation of objective truth, if that is possible at all. Because the facts tell us very little about the truth. I'm sure many of you are aware of the dilemma facing anyone who tries to tell a story. It is, whose facts? Which facts will I use? My facts may be true in my mind, there may be falsehoods in someone else's mind. And it is the eternal dilemma that the historian faces. What should we remember? And given that the facts tell us so little about the truth, I'm conscious of trying, therefore, to find the evidence, if you like, for what happened in the past, for what happened in the Vietnam War. And the journey took me, I was just saying to a lady earlier, about the journey of writing this book, of what it involved personally for me. And I soon realized when I took it on that you can't tell the story of the Vietnam War without telling, in fact, three stories: the military, political, and social history of that decade of peace and love. And it exhausted me. It was a most harrowing experience for a writer, let alone for obviously the people I'm writing about. I came out of it at the end. A digger said to me, he saw me at the beginning, he saw me at the end, and said, "You look 10 years older. You look as if you've actually been, you actually ought to go into rehab after this." But I have spent many, many hours in interviewing hundreds of veterans of this war. I'm just a writer. I'm a cipher for their stories. And I have, I suppose, two skills to bring to the task. One is to listen to what they experienced, and then hopefully to write it down in a way that is reasonably coherent. But what should we remember? Now, I came across so much information, of course. I have 20 to 25 box loads of information. And what do I choose from those box loads? What should people remember about the Vietnam War? Well, I give you an example of just the level of detail that is required and the harrowing details that came across my desk in simply researching this. In a chapter which I believe was the toughest by far for me to write in this book, simply called Body Count. The body count being the American strategy, the actual name of the strategy used to defeat the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese. The net body count per day measured progress in the eyes of American military planners. But in tracing the history of a human body from the battlefield home, that is a history, the history of the dead, the history of what happens to a man who is shot, what becomes of him. How is he sent home? How is the news relayed to the family? And I came across a man called Captain Michael Bindley, who is a notification officer. His job was to inform the next of kin about the loss of their son or their husband. Now, Captain Bindley wouldn't speak to me. He couldn't discuss it in person. He felt it was too difficult, and he had tried before and always broke down and had to stop. But he was happy to send me a couple of emails about his job. And he wrote them in a sort of staccato bullet points. And I'll just read to you. It's basically a description of what he did. I'll just read to you what he sent me, which I quoted pretty much in full in the book. He recounts the details of two visits to the next of kin of two soldiers. Notification on member of 2RAR. 2nd Battalion, Royal Australian Regiment, suffering from serious shrapnel wounds and loss of leg. Next of kin, father, at party with family and friends. I proceed to location. 9 p.m. news on car radio announces details of incident in Vietnam, including killed in actions and serious wounds. Arrive at address as given. Sounds of party inside. Knock on door answered by woman. Inform her I am from the army and wish to talk to soldier's father. Woman informs everybody in shocked voice who is at door. Cries that soldier has been killed from inside as they have heard the 9 o'clock news. Statement by me in loud voice. It's all right. He's not dead. He's only lost a leg. Reaction to my dreadful statement. One of apparent relief. Pause as I give details to the next of kin. Asked to stay for quiet drink. Declined. As I felt like hiding somewhere. Then, a few months later, Michael Bindley calls at approximately 3 p.m. with details of killed in action and next of kin location, a small shop in Newtown. Door answered by female. Sister? Immediate recognition of situation by family. He arrives in his uniform with the padre. Padre immediately takes control and comforts family. Remain as long as necessary until friends and relatives arrive to comfort family. Return journey requires pit stop at local Newtown pub. I go directly to the toilet. On return to the bar, in uniform, one of the drinkers confronts me and shouts, "Up the Viet Cong!" My immediate reaction is to shirt front individual, push against wall, and inform him of what I have just done. Comments create absolute silence in the bar. May have known killed in action and family. Silence enough time for me to realize that immediate withdrawal is necessary. Another notification completed. No follow-up or debrief provided by the system. I think those pretty much encapsulate certainly the job of one man, but in a sense, the whole Vietnam War experience. It draws together the dead, the soldiers living, and the reaction of the protest movement to the Vietnam War in one small message to me by this man. And so once I've looked at that, once I've looked at what happens to an Australian soldier and to his family, and there are far worse examples here which I won't read to you, I feel obliged as a historian to look at the Vietnamese experience, the Viet Cong experience, the North Vietnamese experience. How did they hear about the hundreds of thousands, the millions who were killed and wounded on their side? And I suppose it's something of a torment for me, this urge always to look at the other side, which I tried to do in Dakota. It led me to discover an extraordinary thing about the North Vietnamese, that the women, the mothers, the wives, were never told What happened to their husbands and sons? They never received any notification. They received no word of what became of their sons and, of course, daughters, because many young women were fighting in the North Vietnamese army. For propaganda reasons, Hanoi refused to disclose the horrendous casualty rate that their nation was inflicting, was being inflicted upon them. But the mother's fury sparked an extraordinary protest led by a Mrs. Thap, or Mrs. Thap. And she led a sort of regiment of women known as Mrs. Thap's soldiers against General Giap, the commanding officer, the commanding general of the North Vietnamese army. And she demanded that Giap release the details of what had happened to their loved ones. They naturally wished to mourn properly. They wanted to hold a funeral service, because in the Buddhist tradition, if the body is not laid to rest, it tends to wander in limbo. And of course, some wanted to remarry legally. But this protest went on for years until Giap won. He refused to disclose any details until after the war. They realized that many of their menfolk and their daughters and sons had been killed. I mention these two stories because I think that they do tell us something about what we should try and remember about war, is the sacrifice, is the loss. But on a bigger scale, in the bigger picture, I've tried to pull together, as I said, the strands of three different narratives: the social, the political, and the military, because they're inextricably linked. You can't tell one without bumping up against the other very quickly. You find yourself talking about the returning soldiers, and immediately you run into the protest movement at the airport. You find yourself trying to tell the story of the political story and the cables between governments, and you suddenly realise that the Anzus Treaty means very little. The Americans treated it with absolute contempt throughout the Vietnam War, and the so-called dollars for diggers, the mantra of the left during the period that we were giving younger men's lives in return for US dollars, is also a falsehood. There were no trade concessions extended to Australia during the Vietnam War, if one adopts that crude understanding of what war ultimately is, something of a commercial relationship between allies. But having taken on that challenge, we have to ask ourselves why. Because it's all very well saying what happened and telling the facts as I understand them and stringing them together into a narrative, but at the end, hopefully, if we enter into the story with a clear head, with an objective spirit — I often use the metaphor of clearing out the attic of my brain to refurnish it with a story that I think best reflects the evidence — once we've done that process, once the historian has completed that process, we should arrive at an answer to the question of why, to reason why. The soldier's job may not be to reason why, but it's certainly my job. And we have to then ask ourselves the origins, go back to the origins of the war. Now, we haven't got all day here to talk about that, but certainly we know the nominal reasons for engaging in the Vietnam War, the domino theory, the idea that Vietnam was the first domino in a series that would cascade towards Australia, leading to Chinese domination, if not, in fact, control of Australia. The US alliance: we went to war to shore up the Anzus Treaty, which, in fact, is simply an obligation to consult on defence matters. It has never been a security blanket around Australia's shoulders. It has never been anything other than an agreement to consult. And that, therefore, we're going to war to shore up an alliance which, in fact, is just an agreement to talk about defence issues. Now, to contain communism, the book goes into this in great detail, but I would just alert you in summary, to summarise this point, I suppose, to a message, a secret cable sent by the Assistant US Defence Secretary in 1966, about a month before our first conscripts arrived in Vietnam. He sent it to the Pentagon. He said the original reasons, if I'm paraphrasing here, of why we're going to war are academic. It is now largely to win, to shore up US pride. we were essentially going to war as part of the as part of the armory of the United States ego. And I can see, one can see their point. They didn't want to lose the war. That would send a very bad message to other rogue nations. And but the original reasons that I've just cited, the domino theory, the containment of communism, now these reasons for going to war in 1965 had largely dissipated, if not completely. The collapse of the Soviet-Chinese communist bloc in 1960, the fact that communism itself in China was imploding under Mao Zedong's mad policies. But another reason that this book explores is the case for defending a Christian outpost in Southeast Asia. Along with the Philippines, South Vietnam was the one nominally Catholic country in the region. And certainly the breakaway Democratic Labour Party, the DLP, along with Bob Santamaria, did see this as a holy war. It certainly was in the minds also of Brigadier Ted Sarong, one of a very, very controversial Australian commander, who was a very devout Catholic. And that was another reason seen for the case for fighting this war. Now, the book, I'm not making any further comments or judgments about those reasons. The book does try to explore them in a narrative form, which I hope brings to bear something of whether they were hollow or had any substance. And certainly the domino theory, I think we would all agree, had substance in the 1950s, up until certainly the collapse of the communist bloc. But what did we achieve, therefore, in Vietnam? And I know there are veterans present, and I think that one of the key things that this book brings out is about the soldier story, is what they achieved. And I'm happy to answer questions about this later, but it seems to me, reading the histories that existed before I started writing, that the soldier story was very underrepresented in the libraries, in the kilometres of shelf space devoted to the Vietnam War. There was political theories, there were many histories about the peace movement, there were battalion histories, of course, but very difficult for the general reader to penetrate. But a general history of what the soldier actually did in Vietnam bears a story which is quite contrary to the one that we presume, which popular accounts tell us what happened. For example, the idea that they committed atrocities. We find very quickly that the Australian soldiers did not commit atrocities. This is just a myth. And then the book goes into that in some detail. The soldiers, by and large, acquitted themselves extremely well in Vietnam. They did what they were asked to do, what this country elected the government to ask them to do. And it is borne out by the attitudes of the Vietnamese soldiers I interviewed, that the Australians were extraordinarily restrained. Of course, there were terrible accidents and things went disastrously wrong at times. And we look at, in detail, at the minefield, perhaps one of the worst examples of a misjudgment in the Australian. Certainly worse than a misjudgment, an absolute disaster for the Australian commitment to Vietnam. But by and large, as I've said, the tactics used by the Australians, the approach to how they fought, they eschewed the body count. By and large, commanders thought this was absurd, that the idea was to actually secure villages, not destroy them, not to lay waste to a village because someone fires upon a passing patrol, but to cordon them off, enter them at dawn, interview the occupants, and to secure the village and stay there. And at the end of the war, we see at the end of the Australian war, we see that Phuc Thuy province was largely secure and largely peaceful. It's an extraordinary, if you just take that story in isolation for a moment, of course, nothing can be taken in isolation, but you see, therefore, that this was an achievement that very few people care to look at, because the story of Vietnam is so disturbing, is so relentlessly depressing for so many people. It is about a war that was lost by the West, by and large. It was about a war that led to the most disturbing repercussions in the minds and bodies of those who participated. And yet there were things that can be drawn from it that we can say with pride that the Australians did this, they were ordered to do this, and they did it well. What should we therefore remember about this war if we are going to talk about remembrance? What is it that we take away from it? What lessons should a politician remember about this war? And I'm always, when I talk to politicians, they're always a little wary of historians. They're a little worried about us. They're terrified of being obviously cast negatively, or worse, just being turned into a footnote. And I therefore try to, when I ask, what should we remember about this, or what lessons can we take from it? I think that as we look at the war in Iraq and now in Afghanistan, these lessons from Vietnam, if you just look at a tactical point of view, the Australian war as fought, the tactical war as fought by the Australians in Vietnam was one which, as I've said, was largely restrained and looked at trying to secure territory. That's happening in Afghanistan. That doesn't justify the war in Afghanistan, but it is, from a military point of view, something that can be drawn from the Vietnam War. But on a larger scale, from a political perspective, from a human and moral perspective, nothing much can be said or taken from Vietnam without a feeling of despair and a feeling of deep remorse for what happened there. I devoted my last chapter to asking the question why. And I'd just like to read you, if I can, just a few excerpts. But before I do so, I just want to touch upon the school of thought, largely in America, which seeks to justify the Vietnam War. Yeah, I call it the woulda, coulda, shoulda school of military history. We would have won had the press not turned against us. We could have won had Congress not turned off the money. We should have won had we been allowed to invade the North. Nuke the North, as some even suggest. And this just won't do. These appeals of people who are of historians are refusing to face the fact that this was a war whose limits, and it was called a limited war, whose limits were imposed by the Americans. Limited war in that context means non-nuclear. They weren't going to use nuclear weapons, and they weren't going to invade or send infantry into North Vietnam. And on their own terms, however way you look at it, America lost. Now, who wins or loses wars, especially a war like Vietnam, is something that you know, one can, and certainly they do in America, argue over this, you know, for weeks and months, years, they're still arguing about it. Who ultimately cares who won or lost? What we have to look at is why it was won or lost and at what cost. And I think that cost is best demonstrated by the ways that people grieve and the ways that war affects the participants. And as I wrote in my last... I'll just see how we're going for time. Oh, my gosh, it's... I want to give some time for questions. So I went to a... I went travelling around Phuc Thuy province and I interviewed many South Vietnamese people. I came across a... I'll read it. In South Vietnam, many elderly couples mourn their children, and not as it should be, the other way around. I encountered an old Vietnamese couple in a hamlet near Dat Do. An Australian soldier, they said, had killed their daughter when she was a teenager. They led me into the garden. Against a back wall, under a shelter, stood a little shrine to the girl, with a photograph, flowers, joss sticks, and various letters. The couple attended this shrine for 40 years. I felt like apologizing. On behalf of whom? For what? The girl's mother smiled at my confusion. Then her eyes filled with tears, she staggered backwards, and her husband led her inside. I stayed and looked at the photo of this girl, an innocent child, a Viet Cong soldier. In Australia, Brian McFarlane, an officer in Vietnam, thought that he had conquered his feelings. He felt the war occupied but a corner of his mind. Then one day in 2006, he took a stroll with fellow retired officers along the memorial walkway at Inaugura Barracks. The party passed a little plaque to Private Gordon Knight, the first national serviceman in McFarlane's company to die. He was 21. McFarlane has never forgotten the sight of the young man embracing family and friends on the night of their departure for South Vietnam in 1966. beside a private knight's plaque, beside the path 40 years on, summoned a rush of memories that quite overwhelmed Macfarlane. He told me, "I walked away from my friends to a quiet spot and cried as I have never done before, deeply and long. I cried for the loss of Knight and the misery it must have brought to his family and for the whole miserable pain of this war." And the soldier wept. And that is how two families, individuals, dealt with the memory of this war some 40, 50 years on. And I think that when we remember, if we remember as they are doing, then we certainly can grasp the enormity of the sacrifice and the enormity of the pain of war, which is what my books try to try to conjure in the reader's minds. Thank you very much, and I welcome any questions. We've got a bit of time for questions, actually. I mean, I can talk all day, of course, but I'm happy to talk in response to anything you might have to say about the book or the war. Yeah.
You talked about the justifications for going into the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
How would you compare those justifications against the importance of those justifications, against the importance of the justifications for going into the First World War for us?
Yeah. Big question here. It is a very good question, because this is what always we're trying to do, I suppose it leads into the point of what is a just war, is what, in a sense, you're asking. If it is seen as a just war, therefore, presumably, we should be involved in it. And there's a great deal of work written about when and why we should commit. There's a very strict definitions of what is a just war, but in my understanding, Vietnam War and World War I were not just wars, in the sense that they were not fought for reasons which directly imperiled, and I'm talking about this from an Australian perspective, your question relates to us, which directly imperiled this country, our defence interests, our people. You might argue that we had a duty to the motherland. A duty of the motherland, does that extend to the cost of tens of thousands of young men's lives? The question about a just war is at what cost are we prepared to do this? And that is the question that one has to ask about the Vietnam War as well. At what cost are we prepared to expend 521 young lives and 3,000 wounded, some of them absolutely appallingly as a result of mines? At what cost are we prepared to do that? Is this war just? Are we threatened? Are we directly threatened? I would argue that the reasons for the Great War are highly complex. I mean, the amount of literature on it is extraordinary. But essentially, it was a war that was avoidable. But it was a war that was planned. And this is the thing that often people forget, is that wars are planned. Wars are decided upon. There's nothing inevitable about a war. Politicians decide to go to war, and they bring the nation with them. And at the time, it's immensely popular. Hence, it shores up their leadership. Does it make it right? Does it make it just? And I would argue that World War I was unjust. Hence, the reasons for getting involved are deeply questionable. The Vietnam War, for different reasons, I believe was unjust. So I hope that helps to answer your question. So,
it's my understanding that Vietnam was never a declared war, never a formal war, and that had implications and repercussions in terms of military discipline. The people, members of the military forces, could not be compelled to go to Vietnam. And I am aware of cases where people were court-martialed and the court-martial was lost on that basis.
Yeah.
Do you address that question?
Certainly, it was undeclared war. But I haven't in detail addressed the legal case to which you refer. But it does surprise me that if there was no war declared, on what grounds, therefore, do we have to send soldiers to war?
It was, of course, suggested that their careers wouldn't go ahead after this. They're off walking out the door, which is what
yes. happened. Yeah, that's right. I mean, the National Service Act did oblige anyone called up to obey the government of the day, which possibly overrode any semantic nuances about whether a war was declared or not, and the legal case that you refer to, I suppose, has not really been addressed in any great detail. I haven't come across much work on that, but it's an interesting point.
It's not talked about.
No. Yes, sir.
I know you deal with it in the book, but I'd be interested in your views on the selective conscription that was introduced, and was that, you see, just as a product of the time? I mean, it seemed absolutely extraordinary that that could ever be introduced again.
I devote a lot of attention to it, and as many of you know, the diggers were called the conscripts. They were conscripted at the roll of a dice, effectively a roll of a marble, which numbered balls with their birth date, which if it corresponded with your birth date, you were called up. It was hardly in the spirit of the Anzac, was it, to actually send men to war on that basis? Because you might be called up, your best friend is overlooked, the unlucky ones. Well, many of them saw themselves as lucky at the time. A great adventure were doomed to a conflict which would irreparably mar many of them for the rest of their lives, and their peer group was spared that horror. And I think that your last point, I don't think we'll ever see that again. I can't imagine that a government could survive the introduction of arbitrary conscription at random. And at the time, it was the first blood for the peace movement was over conscription to fight in a foreign battlefield. We had never conscripted soldiers to fight on foreign soil, with the exception of a few islands during World War II, towards the end. But to fight in a major battlefield, Australia had never conscripted soldiers, let alone at the roll of a dice. And this was regarded with horror by growing numbers of Australians as the 60s progressed, and was, I think, one of the key reasons why the Korean War was accepted, and the Vietnam War certainly wasn't. But in many ways, they were similar wars. They were both Cold War, both front lines of the Cold War. But you sent regular soldiers to Korea. It was their career choice to join the army. Hence, they had to obey the government of the day. Any further discussion? Or yes?
Yeah. Well, you're talking about the Americans going into a limited war.
Yeah.
Being non-nuclear. Okay, if we go back to the Korean, well, go back to the French with the Vietnamese, apparently they were offered nuclear weapons by America and refused. MacArthur wanted to drop, what is it, 30 bombs along the nuclear bombs, including cobalt
in Korea.
Bombs, along the border of North Korea. And it just makes you wonder, there's obviously these hawks out there. In all your research, did you come across any sort of disparity of agreement amongst the American commanders that there were like-type people who wanted to drop nuclear weapons on Vietnam?
The limited war, just to go back to the beginning of the question, limited being non-nuclear but also contained within South Vietnam. So limited geographically and limited by the choice of a weapon. That didn't stop them using, of course, napalm and white phosphorus and a whole range of modern new weapons, which were, absolutely horrific effects. Certainly you're right. MacArthur wanted to use nuclear bombs in Korea, and so did a large portion of the American public. I've just finished a book on the destruction of Japan, on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So I looked into the history of the bomb in great detail, and its subsequent history, and not only that, but they want to irradiate the border, keep it irradiated by constantly bombing that no man's land between North and South Korea. So it was talked about. It was an open question. It was debated. In the case of Korea, and certainly the French requested tactical nuclear weapons to bail them out of the bloodbath of Dien Bien Phu. And the Truman refused in the case of Korea, and of course they refused in Vietnam. Now this was the commanders on the ground in Vietnam never raised the question of, as far as I'm aware, never raised the question of using nuclear weapons, because they realised that this would bring China and the Soviet Union into the war in a nuclear capacity. That was a recipe for nuclear war. But back The civilians are usually the most gung-ho in all wars. They're usually the most bloodthirsty in my experience. You know, nuke them, throw everything you can at them. But the poor soldiers at the front line are, you know, just trying to manage this dreadful situation. The last thing they want is a bloodthirsty civilians in the rear telling them what to do. But it's certainly in Washington, there was great there were many calls to nuke North Vietnam. So it was a political. The politicians were talking about it. The Pentagon realized that this was madness, by and large, and certainly Johnson refused. We're talking about the hawks, and they're not always on the far right. One has to remember that the opponents to the nuclear bomb that fell on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that the key opponents at the time were on the Republican side. MacArthur certainly opposed to it. Eisenhower was opposed to it. Even Curtis LeMay was opposed to it because it stole his thunder. I'm reminded of this was essentially an infantry war. All wars are ultimately won by the infantry, if we're not talking about nuclear. And Mao Zedong famously said, I will fight the Americans to the last Vietnamese. He certainly knew whose infantry he was using. Yes, at the back.
In the last week in Adelaide, the Advertiser has had a series of letters, and a statement here that every conscript who served in Vietnam was in fact a volunteer for the service and had signed a document to that effect. I don't think I did that, and I'd like to inquire.
Which unit were you in?
Sorry.
Did you were a veteran? You were a veteran,
yes.
Yeah. Which battalion were you?
I was in a
unit?
Ordinary.
Yeah. Ordnance. This is an interesting question, and I've debated this in the book actually. That were they volunteers or were they conscripts? And obviously they were conscripted. They were called up and they were ordered to show themselves at the recruitment centre. Then they were sent off to Pakapanyo or Inogara or wherever to train. Now, once they'd gone through their year of recruit training, in some battalions, and indeed down to company and platoon level, you found some officers in various ways, whether on a parade ground or individually, however they chose to do it, in some cases said to the conscripts, said to the national servicemen, are you prepared to go to battle? Do you want to go to battle? And this is, I think, where this arises from. And in one company, the company commander has told me, he put them on parade and said, anyone who doesn't want to go to Vietnam, take a step forward. Of course, nobody did. And there was one case, I think, and he was abused and treated, ostracized and bundled out of the battalion. And so no commander wanted to take reluctant soldiers. This was the point. So even though they were compelled to be in the army, once they'd done recruit training, they were mates. They were all, their peer groups had formed sort of very close relationships with each other. There was no way they weren't going to go to war. So it was kind of academic even, really, to even suggest that you have the choice. That may be where this is coming from, but they certainly were not volunteers. They were compelled to go. Willingly, in most cases. Contrary to the idea that they were reluctantly hauled off to Vietnam. I mean, most diggers went willingly. It's just a fact.
Just yes. On that point, no, yeah. I don't ever remember signing to say I go to Vietnam, but when you were as for a national serviceman, obviously at the end of basic training you were selected to go to a corps, and a lot more people go to infantry than any other corps, and all infantry battalions go to Vietnam.
Of course. And the national servicemen didn't have time. It wasn't the time to specialise, as one of the commanders told me. They were trained for infantry, and this was where the idea that national servicemen were cannon fodder for Australia arises. They simply didn't have the time, the practical resources to train a new recruit in, whatever it might be, whether it's surveying or in mine laying or in the engineers. Yes.
actually the national servicemen, if they wanted to join the SAS, Special Air Service Regiment, they had to sign on for an extra year.
Right, yeah, I've met some who did. Mm. And of course, there were officers amongst the national servicemen who went to Skyville and performed extremely well. I mean, I think they compressed into 6 months what officers at Duntroon and Portsea had to achieve. It was quite an incredibly intense course. Yes?
Paul, I've been dipping in and out of your book for the last couple of years, but yeah. And enjoyed it, but I haven't yet read your analysis of the dominant theory, etc.
Yeah.
Something I criticise are those authors who don't take into consideration the fact that there was still a guerrilla campaign going on in Malaysia. There were still remnants of the communists in Indonesia, mainly flattened.
Yeah.
There was infiltration into and communist guerrilla activity in the Isthmus of Kra in Thailand. Northern Burma, there was infiltration, Pakistan and China.
Mm-hmm.
Many people just discount all that when they poo-poo the idea of the dominant theory. As I haven't read your analysis, what did you make of those?
Certainly, I agree with that in every respect. There were guerrilla movements throughout Southeast Asia, throughout the 50s, and this was the decade of the Malayan emergency. And the Defence Department, and indeed the armed forces at the time, regarded the line of forward defence as being the Malayan barrier.
Mm.
This was where we would fight any threat to Australia if these communist forces were to organise, were to become a monolithic force. But the reality was that by the end of the 50s, the Chinese terrorists, the CTs in Malaya were defeated.
They were isolated.
They were very much isolated, not an effective force.
Yeah.
And there was no linkage. The linkages on which the domino theory was based simply weren't occurring. They weren't able to organise. They were isolated groups within these countries. But the threat and the perception was understandable, and I agree with that. And certainly in the 50s, that perception was palpable. And we even had Casey, the external affairs minister at the time, raising the prospect of Australian kids hauling fat Asians around on rickshaws. He made that speech in Toorak, I think, the Toorak Conservative Club. So this was taken seriously, and the communist menace, we all remember, or we've read or heard about the crimson tides washing ashore, the red tide coming ashore. But in the 60s, one has to... The thing is that you can't look at history as a static... It's always moving, it's always changing, it's very fluid, so you have to look at it as it changes. And so if one accepts that the domino theory was a justified fear and possibly could possibly lead to a real threat to Australia in the 50s, that threat had been largely removed by the end of the 50s, but the actual mantra of the domino theory started just as the threat was dissipating. The propaganda about it and the use of it by politicians to justify the Vietnam War was just rising. So you see these two counter effects happening. That summarizes really my understanding of the domino theory. Yes?
During the Vietnam War, I was a student at Caulfield Technical College, and I was about to put my name into the barrel. We had a mathematics instructor who was a World War II veteran. Well, he always wore the RSL badge, and he was badly affected by the Second World War. He used to limp badly, and he'd grimace with pain if he came around to your desk to help you with a maths problem when he got up. He had a son at that technical college who was also 20 and about to go into the barrel.
Yeah.
And he made it publicly known at the college that his son would go to Vietnam over his dead body. And of course that had quite a significant effect on myself and others that were willingly putting our names into the barrel. My question is, from your experience, was it very common for RSL members such as he to oppose the Vietnam War at that time? I'm talking about 1966-67.
The RSL at the time, in my understanding, were very much in favour of the Vietnam War. They were very, very gung-ho behind it in the early 60s. While the members of the RSL largely regarded it as they called it, a police action and hardly worthy of the name of war, the Second World War veterans, I suppose that comment is mostly made about. The RSL as an organisation backed the Vietnam War. They certainly backed. They had doubts about national service, whether you could conscript a man and put him into a regular army unit. They had serious misgivings about whether that would work. And in fact, it did work brilliantly. And the regulars and the conscripts got on very well and forged extraordinarily good regiments. But they didn't oppose the Vietnam War on the grounds that you're describing. And I think that must have been an isolated example. Certainly I haven't come across much of that. But interesting to look at the RSL's reaction at the end of the war. Many branches, it wasn't an institutional thing, but many branches refused membership to Vietnam veterans or discouraged their application for membership. One has to be careful, because the RSL is a multifaceted organisation and some branches behave in different ways to other branches. It's a very complex and extraordinary. Someone could do a great PhD studying the RSL as a sort of anthropological experience, really. But some branches certainly discouraged Vietnam veterans. They said, you know, one veteran I spoke to said he was told, "Sonny, you didn't fight a war. You're in a police action. We're not encouraging your members." Which is why the direct evidence, really, for this is why the Vietnam veterans have formed such an extraordinarily well-oiled organization themselves. I mean, in parallel to the RSL, they realized they had to do it themselves. And you now have the Australian Vietnam Veterans Associations throughout the country, which are incredibly influential, very strong lobby groups, and have won, compared with the RSL and other wars, they've won those are some great concessions from the government. I mean, most veterans may argue with that, but certainly they're a very effective lobbying force. And I'm going away from your point, but yes. Any more? Yes.
Being a British person, in the 60s, the majority of Brits were for the Vietnam War. I want to make a general point here.
Yeah.
I can't see how the Vietnam War would have been avoided. When I think back to the French effort, because the Americans subsidized the French effort by 75% of finance.
Certainly. But you're saying that
I can't see how it could have been avoided. I mean, the Americans were always supported the French hugely. Mm. I couldn't see them. You know, I think they saw it as an extension.
Well, it's certainly the Americans fought the same war as the French. They didn't learn anything from it. They certainly didn't read their history, because I'll get to your point. But I'm interested in the connection between the French and the American wars as fought, because they both faced the same tactic, same strategy was thrown at both armies and humiliated both armies or their commanders, because the whole point of the Viet Minh and then the Viet Cong and the national and the North Vietnamese armies was to fight the war forever, effectively, to never give in. But it's one thing to say that the North Vietnam's takeover of the South was the start of a domino effect that would spread throughout the whole of Asia. And another thing to say, well, this is a local civil war, some describe it. And we're still arguing about what the Vietnam War, in fact, was. Now, if we accept that it was a proxy war between the superpowers, which is, I think, what you...
That's right.
Now, that was avoidable. I mean, the reason that triggered the proxy war was the Tonkin Gulf incident, which was manufactured. It didn't happen, as reported, but that was the case for sending large numbers of American troops into Vietnam, and it's covered in detail. I won't go into it now. It's a very complex story. But the once the Americans had used the Tonkin Gulf incident to justify sending infantry, large numbers of infantry into Vietnam, that drew in China and the Soviet Union, who were not engaged in the Vietnam War until then. So here we have, you know, it was a situation that was avoidable. And it's to the greatest regret of many of the commanders at the time. They could see that this was happening, and suddenly you had a war being fought on the battlefield of South Vietnam between America, Soviet. So was it inevitable? I wouldn't necessarily share that view.
Well, I mean, the financial commitment by America.
Yeah.
I mean, even through the French bombs, I can't see how there's have to be a big break somewhere to not go ahead. I mean, they're obviously this saw as a carry on.
America, in spite of what a lot of us think, are not a colonial power in the traditional sense, the British and French sense. And they weren't in favour of the French being there. They certainly weren't in favour of the Dutch being in what was now Indonesia, Dutch East Indies, and they certainly weren't in favour of the British being in India. I mean, the Americans have been an anti-colonial influence in that traditional sense. So they didn't support the French. I mean, the French were pleading for assistance, and they refused to help them. They had financial backing, I agree, but this was a two-way bet. They also backed Ho Chi Minh, if you remember, in 1945, as a way of getting rid of the Japs. But
just one more question.
Yeah.
Paul, first of all, I am not a Vietnamese vet, but my friend here was, and we were in the same class, school, and faced that horrible period where you were in the barrel and some went, some didn't. One of the things that's really amazed me now that I've read as much as I have about it is the ignorance of us at home about what went on. I know through John what's gone on, but a lot more. But one of the things that seems to be sort of a space that hasn't been answered yet is the way the politicians, and I wonder whether you ever got to really interview any of them, the surviving politicians that are still there, that made some of those decisions about that whole scene. Whether they ever displayed a regret that they made a bad decision. I guess that their ego won't let them, but one in particular that's still around and pretty vociferous.
Yeah, I interviewed him. You're talking about Malcolm Fraser.
Yes.
I interviewed him at length. And in fact, we just made a movie based on the book, or some aspects of the book, which is coming out next year. And we interviewed Malcolm Fraser in it. And I put to him, do you regret this? And are you prepared to apologise to the soldiers? And I think in this case, an apology does have some substance. I'm always a bit of sceptical about public apologies by politicians for something that happened hundreds and hundreds of years ago, perhaps. But the veterans are here with us. They're still enduring post-traumatic stress disorder. They're still they're still dealing with the memory. It is perhaps, and he refused. He said, "Well, there's no point. Nothing can be achieved." He said, "In me apologising, or this was a collective decision made before I became Army Minister and subsequently Defence Minister, and I inherited it." Now, McNamara has written a book about his involvement in Vietnam. He's the most sort of, I suppose, prominent example of a politician who has recanted, regretted what happened. But they never actually use the word apologise. They never actually see it as a personal, that their decision led to this. It's certainly their decision at the time, but afterwards it becomes a collective decision and something that they have no direct responsibility for. That's what I've experienced in reading and in interviewing Mr. Fraser. I suppose you could argue that that if there's going to be an apology, it should be on behalf of the government rather than a particular individual. Or certainly one man can't necessarily be blamed for the burden of this, of what's happened in Vietnam. But I think certainly that government, the New Zealand government, has in fact apologised to those who suffered from herbicide poisoning and Agent Orange. So that's an interesting development. I don't think that's happened anywhere else in the world. I think that's all we have time for.
Thanks very much, Paul, for coming today. And just on behalf of the Shrine, the First Token, our appreciation.
Thanks very much.